I hear people talking right about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on the wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe the fact. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight inside me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a foreign dynasty. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you run down my country, man. You walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Today I'm going to play this week's ethno-state. Our guests this week, of course, are Chairman of the American Freedom Party, William Johnson, and Ken Givenan. And this is called The Trump Cult and Other Issues. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
Hello, everyone. This is William Johnson, Chairman of the American Freedom Party, with another scintillating discussion about the current events with Ken Givenan. He and I will be the only two on it today, and I think it'll be interesting to look at these shows in retrospect after the passing of 20 years to see what our take is on it when America has transformed so dramatically in our lifetimes. That we're going to see what you guys will think back on us 20 years hence. But in any event, giving a nod to history, Ken told me that today is St. George's Day. And I didn't know much about St. George. I do remember something about him slaying a dragon. But Ken says, well, Paul McCartney of the Beatles wished everybody a St. George's Day, Happy St. George's Day. And Ken says, well, he's so very left-wing. Where did you pick up on that, Ken? Not that he's left-wing, but where did you pick up that he wished everybody a St. George's Day?
He posted that on Twitter, but I saw it on BBC, on their news account.
Okay. So I think that the reason why he did that is because St. George's Day is very important in England, where he's from. And I don't think he meant to have any sort of political statement in that, because I did just glance briefly at some of the articles, and there was a movement to make St. George's Day a bank holiday. But I was a little bit suspicious as that if he's really a Red Cross bearing slayer of bad things, then I don't know why Paul McCartney would praise it, because he's one of the entrenched left. So I did look a little bit, and it was enlightening that Ken, you mentioned that he had something to do with the Muslims. So I looked at that to see what was going on. What does St. George do with the Muslims? It turns out that the Muslims like him. The Muslims are trying to rehabilitate, or trying to find connections with him. And I guess some of their Persian writings, they say, oh, and St. George was killed three times in one day, and he was resurrected all three times. And because of the popularity of St. George among the Anglo-Saxon people, particularly in England, that they try to find connections with him. So I think that it is certainly not a statement by Paul McCartney that is anti-Muslim, for what it's worth. The only time I really heard of St. George is St. George, Utah, because I have to go through St. George from L.A. to BYU, where five of my kids attended. And they're quick to point out that St. George was not named after St. George of England, but one of the Mormon prophets, George Albert Smith. So for what all that's worth. Well, I guess enough rambling. Let's get down to the topics of the day.
By the way, 20 years from now, I'll be 86. I'm not sure I care what anybody thinks.
20 years from now, I'll still be working in my law office. So, and I won't be much younger than 86. But, you know, maybe when I'm 106, I'll retire. Yeah. In any event, so let's take a look at the first topic that I want to discuss. It's been a topic of conversation everywhere, is the terrorist attack in Sri Lanka. So what all have you heard about that? What salient points do you want to talk about with regards to that, Ken?
Well, the salient point that comes to my mind is that the response of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. They could not bring themselves to use the word Christian. They called them Easter worshipers. Totally bizarre, but they just can't bring themselves to admit the Muslims attacked Christians. So I don't know what logic they used, but what was kind of interesting about that is they did it about the same time. They posted something on Twitter, each of them. It's almost as if they had an agreement beforehand. Or if somebody sent out a note, said, okay, everybody, don't say Christians, say Easter worshipers. But I found that really weird.
Now, I didn't hear the specifics of it coming from Obama and Clinton, but I did hear that a lot of news sources declined to use the word Christian. So I think it was more pervasive and far-reaching than just those two politicians. But that brings up a related matter, is that someone postulated that we might be at an era when we start needing to say not just Islamophobic or homophobic, but Christianphobic or Christio. I'm not sure how you would conjunct those two words, those portmanteau, those words. But
I said Christophobic.
Have you heard that word before? I didn't hear it until today or yesterday.
No, I just made it up a few months ago. I was thinking something like you were thinking now. I said, we'll
oh, you did make it. Oh, so you're the one that coined it then?
Yeah, I'll take credit for it, sure.
Okay, so how do you pronounce it?
Christophobic.
Christophobic. Well, just this morning, I talked to my wife about that, but I wasn't so artful in my pronunciation. And we discussed that a little bit. And I began to reflect that, at what time did we first start having anti-Christian or Christophobic context in today's society? What do you say about that, Ken?
Well, what I say is, when I was growing up, 50s and 60s, about the same time you were growing up, that it was actually to be a Christian was very positive. That people found that you're Christian, they kind of admired your stand and your take. Of course, everybody said they were Christian, a lot of them didn't go to church, but people who were dedicated to the faith were admired for their stand.
You know? And where was this?
I grew up in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Okay, because I went to, you know, I started out my life in Arizona, and there it was very pro-Christian, but I spent my junior high school and my high school years in Eugene, Oregon. And I went to church every week, and I always went to church, and I was kind of known as being a devout Christian goer, and I was ridiculed. I was made fun of by all of the cigarette smokers, the potheads, the drinkers. There were aspects where they liked me, but they would also razz me, tease me, and look down upon me for my views. But that being said, I remember going out to a football game, and they're passing beer all around to everybody. And some of these potheads says, "Oh, don't give me Johnson. He won't drink, you know." And they'll give him some. So they were defending me in that respect. But very much in the late 60s and the early 70s, very much the establishment, even then, was starting to be Christophobic. It was not popular to be Christian. It was popular to be more secular. And I think it moved fast and faster than that time. So I asked my wife, so when do you think Christophobia, you know, his anti-Christian beliefs started coming in and we started being attacked for our beliefs? And she put her hands on her hips and she says, well, we were attacked vehemently in the 1830s. Of course, she was more talking about the Mormons. And I said, yeah, but it was the Christians that were attacking us. You know, it wasn't these atheists or the anti-Christians. It was intersecular fighting. She said, well, nevertheless, you know, we were killed and so on. And I said, well, you know, we gave and took at that time.
That goes back to the Reformation. You know, there were people, notable ministers, theologians, who were burned at the stake because they did not believe the Trinity. I mean, some doctrinal issue as trivial as that was not considered trivial at all. It was major heresy. So they take these guys out and burn them at the stake, or they lop off their heads if they were compassionate. Yeah.
Well, I think also, was it Roger Williams who founded Rhode Island? And he found it as an ecumenical group so that everybody could come and worship there without fearing repercussions. But I think some of his people, you know, headed over to Boston, where my ancestors were from, and they said, where are you from? Oh, I'm from Roger Williams Settlement. So they lynched, I think it was a woman, they lynched one guy, and then they burned another at the stake. So even in early America, there was a lot of, you know, internecine fighting, or fighting between, you know, Christian sects.
Well, you know, the colonies outside of Rhode Island were basically religious sects. Uh-huh. You know, each colony was founded for a particular religion. You know,
yeah, and they're hardcore religion. They took care of their own, and then they made sure that the outsiders were taken care of too,
yeah,
in a different manner. But this does bring up a larger point. Right now, we really boo-hoo over individuals and the lives of each individual person. And if you take a look at some of these comments on this Sri Lankan massacre, there will see, you know, one of the headlines, I think, in the Washington Post says that Danish billionaires, three of his four children died in that bombing, and Americans, you know, a white American family died among them, a famous chef. And then if you look at the comments, they're saying, what does it matter if you're a billionaire, son? Every life is tragic. And then they all criticize the headlines for focusing in on the death of a billionaire's son. And if you contrast that to some of the comments when there was like a great hurricane that went through Haiti, for example, when Haiti was still controlled primarily by the French, the comments there would say, well, there was a great hurricane and, you know, 2,000 of people died, but none of them mattered. So, because it was the ones that died were the slaves. So you had a different outlook on life then than now. Back then, at least among Western society, it was the whites that mattered and the others didn't matter at all. And now we look at the situation where they say, oh, it doesn't matter if they're white or if they're billionaire Danish sons, you know, it's everyone should be pitied and worried, and that's kind of true, except for the fact that I do believe we need to move away from this concept of individual life matters more than anything else. I do believe, and a lot of people will take umbrage with this, that the most overrated commodity in the world today is the individual human life. Because we are expanding and breeding so rapidly, so extensively, we are destroying this earth. So I think that maybe a move back to where individual life is not as important as the ideals that we promote is a good concept. And you know, I don't want to be blathering on, but it comes to mind that during the Civil War and even during the First World War, you would have people coming out with picnic baskets, sitting at the side of the battlefield and watching the North attack the innocent South. And there would be battles where people would be bloodshed and be dying. It was kind of like a football game today. And so the people then did not value the human life as much as they valued the principles. And people came out to watch the principles. Yay, go gray, boo, down with the North, or whatever they wanted to do. And then you would also have, in the military, for example, traitors if they were caught, or spies if they were caught. Many times you hear about these spies who don blue uniforms, and they were captured, and then they were hanged. They were killed immediately. And those type of the concept of going after a spy is more important than the individual's life. And so nowadays you wouldn't do that. If you have a heinous murderer, he's still given 20 years of appeals before he's finally put into a mahogany condo. So I don't know. That's my thoughts on that.
While you were talking, I was taking your advice and looking at the comments at yahoonews.com. There is a story that says that ISIS is taking credit for the bombing or responsibility. And one guy says nearly all the world's deadliest terror attacks in the past 20 years have been committed by Islamic extremists. Actually, that goes back 1,400 years. Last month, there were over 700 documented fatalities from the direct result of Islamic attacks. And the month before that, there was 800. This is typical. You know, there are hundreds, almost 1,000 every month. The next guy says, where is the condemnation of our Muslim Congress members? She can't condemn. She's supported by CARE, the guy says. Or is it somebody did something in Sri Lanka? That's making fun of what's her name, you know.
I think it's more insidious than that, because for the first 2 days, maybe only happened 2 days ago, maybe for the first day and a half, they wouldn't even say that it was a Muslim attack. They would say it was Tamil separatists, or it was local infighting. And I looked and I couldn't see that it was terror perpetrated by the Muslims. And that disturbed me, because although Donald Trump has made popular the term fake news, I have been slow to recognize that, and I have been more willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the news media. But I could not find statements that it was a Muslim terrorist attack. It had to be that the Sri Lankan president or the establishment came out and says it was ISIS that did this. It was a Muslim attack in retribution for Christchurch that this happened. Then the news started reporting it. So it is true, Donald Trump has done the nation a service by pointing out that there is an agenda, and it's a subtle presentation of the news that try to shape public opinion, but it was truly a Muslim terrorist attack in Sri Lanka.
Another guy makes a good point. He notes that in New Zealand, a Christian country, quote, Christian, unquote, the perpetrators were arrested, brought to justice. But in Muslim countries, not so. They are hailed as heroes.
Yeah, that's true. But Sri Lanka, I don't believe, is a Muslim country. I believe they have a Christian minority and they have a Muslim minority. But I think the majority of them are probably Hindu, maybe. I'm not sure. I'm not a student. That my sister and her husband did missionary work in Sri Lanka, and they came back just before the blast. Just before maybe 6 months before the blast. But while they were there, they had a blast. They liked the people. They liked the work that they do, and the pictures that they would send home to me. I tell you, all the pictures that they sent home, they had to be taken in the absolute high noon daylight, because there was any shadows in there, you wouldn't be able to see any of the natives, because they were blacker than night. But my sister said that they were friendly, good people, and they were friendly and good to the white people there. But she associated with the Christians and the maybe the local people that were not so imbued with hatred that the Muslim minority there had been imbued with. But in any event, what is going to be the reaction of America and Europe from this heinous attack? Again, I think that it's going to die down very quickly, and it's not going to be an issue. We're going to be reading about and hearing about and following the Christ Church attack much more in our news and in our psyche and in our consciousness than the Sri Lankan attack. All right, anything else that we want to talk about that tragedy before we move on to some of the ones that you brought up? Okay, so then let's talk about your issue. The first one that you have is, let me see, let's go to the most illegal aliens receive government benefits. Can you give us that story, please? Oh, there is it's a big, huge immigration, anti-immigration group. I've spoken to them. I know them. Yeah, it's I don't know what it stands for, but it's something with the I is immigration reform. Immigration reform. Fair. I don't know. I don't subscribe to the conspiracy theory of that statement. I believe it is just a natural development from our misguided altruism. Because what has happened is, during the Dust Bowl, during the Great Depression, during FDR's era, we realized that a lot of people were using Hoover blankets. Do you know what a Hoover blanket is?
I have no idea what a Hoover blanket is.
A Hoover blanket is a newspaper that they would put over them when they slept on a park bench. And so there was such displacement of people. There was such hard times. You know, you had people selling apples on the street. You had people selling pencils on the street, anything to keep the wolf from the door. And so you had the beginning of these safety nets that were put in place to be able to help our people. And I think you had opposition to that from the Republicans, the wealthy Republicans. But the populace, the Democrats, the farmers, the rank and file people supported the safety net because it was designed to help the most tragic of our people. And many countries followed that same example, and maybe even some of them led ahead of us. All of Europe did the same thing. And Australia and New Zealand, every white country did this. They established a safety net for our people to keep them from falling below the poverty level. And the concept was that you had orphans that were needy, and they were the deserving poor, and we wanted to help them up. And people generally were honest. They sometimes needed a helping hand, and they wanted to be able to lift themselves up. And they were in a temporary era or period of extreme poverty. Yet they were honest, they wanted to work, they wanted to eschew the handout when they could. That was the hallmark and of our people in every European country. Basically, the handout was to be short-term until we could rebuild ourselves. But that was not the mindset, that is not the mindset of the immigrants coming in. And so we still have this idea of giving more and more handouts at every level so that you have a different group of people that have a different moral structure, and they're taking advantage of the system, not only in this country and in all white countries. I mean, as soon as they cross the border, they get huge amount of handouts in every country. They get money, they get cell phones, they get cards to use as credit cards, they get clothing. It's just amazing. And you said that they get breakfast and lunch, but that is not all. They get free, so the parents don't want to take care of their kids or they're working or whatever it is, they get free after-school care until the evening, and they get dinners taken home for them. So they get three meals a day. It is just bizarre. And on top of that, they get free housing, they get free education, and every one of them gets free medical coverage because they just have to go to the emergency room to get covered. The last point I want to make, it is not just those people in this system that are gaming the system. And it's not just the immigrants, and it's not just the blacks, and it's not just the degenerate whites that have embraced this system, and all the other myriad of people that I don't want to be leaving out. And I want everybody to gaming the system now except you and me, Ken. But a big gamer of the system are the newspapers and the media and the television stations and the radio stations in the extreme third world, because they promote that on air. They say, hey guys, go to a white country and you will get everything for free. So the guy that is lounging around in his own country, instead of making it a better place, he'll pack up and come to America, because the press there will say, hey, you can get into America, it's easy to get in, and that's what feeds the flood.
I mentioned this a couple months ago, just reflecting on what you were saying, but a couple of years ago, we were vacationing in Vero Beach, Florida, which is one of the whitest cities in that state. Nice place. It does not cater to tourism. One of the reasons we wanted to go there. But I had an issue, so I had to go to the emergency room. When I walked in the door, I didn't see any white people. The nurse was white. One of the security guards. Two security guards was white. Everybody else. And the place was packed. But they were all brown people, most of them Hispanic, some of them black. And I looked at the nurse's station, you know, where they assign people in. And here's a white nurse, and she's cradling this little black toddler. And I looked around and said, man, now I know where all the Hispanic and black people are. They're in the emergency room taken care of, or being taken care of by us. But I wonder, Bill, how many people in that emergency room stopped and considered? The electric lights, they're lighting this place up. Thank you, white people. The air conditioning. Thank you, white people. It's important. The medical care, the technology. Thank you, white people. I would guarantee you not one of those people thought of that. Now, having said that, let me say this. We need to take care of ourselves. Not just on our home turf, but foreign policy. Why are we taking care of all these other countries? But on the home turf, I'm okay with us taking care of our people, but I would prefer the government not get involved in it. Maybe as a referee, but not as a player. Private contributions, I'm okay with.
I think this example that you show ports exactly to this misplaced altruism and the value that they're placing on an individual over the concept of the people as a whole. I mean, she's cradling this little two-year-old black toddler or brown toddler, and all of those people in that room, the emergency room, are going to grow up and displace the white people and take over every country that the white people ever, in every society we've ever had, and they're going to destroy us. And we think, oh, we have to help that little toddler. And when we see these little parentless children that are coming across the border, we have empathy and sympathy for them. But we don't have empathy and sympathy for our descendants of three and four generations hence, who will be hunted and killed and hated if we still exist, And the only solace that they will have in their lives is they'll be able to say, well, at least my grandparents weren't racists. You know, and they will be talking about that as they go down in flames. So we have to realize that the ideology, the principles that our ancestors embraced to create our society cannot be abandoned, and we must promote them and take a 180-degree turn in our directions. And it's a simple matter. What we need to do is we need to change the I in immigration to an E. And if we do that, the problem will be solved.
When we were talking with Paul Fromm last week, he said something that I thought was very insightful. But he noticed that never has there been a conflict, major conflict, between white people and non-white people who we didn't win. He noted that Genghis Khan was maybe the closest to an exception. But still, we won that conflict. Until now. Go back thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. This is the first conflict that we've lost. And the reason is the terms of warfare, in my opinion, are different. They're not shooting us. They're not using aggression. They're getting inside our heads. What you call altruism. Pathological altruism.
That's interesting. Now, you're cutting up. I'm not sure whether it's just me or the whole audience is cutting up, but you're breaking it out for me. But in any event, I'm wondering if that can be applied to Spain for the last 800 years that the Muslims ruled Spain. I don't know that is without exception. If you take a look at the white people in Haiti, they got all killed. That was one war they lost. And if you take a look at South Africa, of course, I guess that's part and parcel of the same disease that's confronting all of us. So maybe that's so. But the game has changed, and we need to change our attitude, or we're goners. But I think we've kind of talked about this enough. I want to talk about my favorite fat lady. So can you read that story, Ken?
Yeah, let me find it here.
And can you tell whether your voice is coming through clearly or not? Because it's really breaking up on my end. Sounds like just like it's a lot of static.
Yeah, the people in the chat group say they can hear it fine.
Okay, all right, very good.
So probably we're okay. Let me see if I can find that. Was that one of our stories?
Oh, yeah. What we're talking about is that I like to listen to old radio shows. And I have listened to Kate Smith many times on the radio, on YouTube or on the radio for several years. I like her show. I like, you know, I don't like God Bless America. I think that's, you know, I don't like that song. But I do like a lot of her shows and a lot of her guests. You know, I like it when she'd have all these old, you know, crazy guests on there that do the comedy. And so I was surprised that, one, that she was popular with this particular show, sporting event, and even they put a statue in her honor, and every time before they begin the game that they sing, they play her rendition of God Bless America. Which sporting event is this, and what city?
Well, I just found it. For some reason, I couldn't, because the time was sports event, I was looking for Kate Smith.
Oh.
But these are two professional ball teams. One of them is the New York Yankees, and the other is the Philadelphia Flyers. And so,
Philadelphia Flyers. Now, what Philadelphia Flyers is what sport?
Hockey. Ice hockey.
Hockey. Okay, right, go on.
But they have taken God Bless America out of their rotation, so I guess they don't play the ball games. I think that's what that means.
But I think they took out Kate Smith's rendition of God Bless America, right?
No, Kate Smith is the issue, not God Bless America, because somewhere back in the 30s, allegedly, she sang the song with the princess.
So they will still have Tupac Shakur's version, or 50 Cent, or something like that.
Yeah, but the Flyers took down her statue. Apparently, they had a statue of her in front of the team stadium. I have no idea why. Well, let's put Kate Smith's statue in front of a sports stadium.
I read why. Because she did two songs, one for a movie, and one song was like, and this is why the darkies do what they do, something like that. And another one was, you know, Pickaninny Heaven, or something like that. And those were both denigrating of the black people. And I don't know how much of a black audience did you have in a hockey game. I don't know very much. But I do know that I remember the first time I learned what the word Pickaninny was. Was that in your lexicon? Had you heard that growing up?
I heard it, but I don't know what the origins of the word is.
But do you know, you heard it? I didn't hear it until I was well into my adulthood. And the first time I heard it was, it was regarding Evan Meekum. Do you remember who Evan Meekum was?
No.
Evan Meekum was the governor of Arizona. He was just a country old boy from Arizona that started got some automobile dealerships. And he was hugely popular, had a whole bunch of automobile dealerships all over Arizona, and I think he would do commercials where he would be kind of homespun and down to earth. And so his automobile dealerships were very, very well received, and he was quite well known, but he was just as country a boy as you can get. Well, he became a governor, and one of his first acts as governor is he says, well, we're not going to have a Martin Luther King holiday because I don't like it. And that just started all sorts. I think they wanted to make it a holiday, and so he vetoed it or something like that. And so every sports team says, well, we're not going to do a Super Bowl in Arizona until you make it a holiday, or we're not going to have the Major League Baseball playoffs until you have a holiday. So all the economic interests and a lot of the left-wing liberals, they wanted to ban Evan Meekum's efforts to stop the Martin Luther King holiday. And so they dug up, he said, well, also, he wrote a book, his biography, and he referred to growing up and had some pickaninnies. And what the heck is a pickaninny? The pickaninny, for those of you who don't know, is a black child. So I don't know what age it's the cutoff at. But because he used that term, they decided to, and because he was against the Martin Luther King holiday, they decided they wanted to impeach him. And they also wanted to charge him with all sorts of fraud or whatever it is. And they kicked him out of office. And that was the first time I heard of that term. But so now they're just attacking every vestige of white America. You know, if you attack Kate Smith, you're attacking 1940s America as more than anything you can get to. Right? So they're taking her out.
While you were talking, I looked it up, and it's a Portuguese word that means little. Or it's a derivative, I should say, of a Portuguese.
Well, is my definition of pickaninny the same as yours?
Yeah, little black kid.
Little black kid, yeah, okay. Well, anyway.
Why is that a racial slur? I mean, little black kids are little, and they're black. Why can't you call them little black kids?
I don't know.
For some reason, somebody decided. You know what yeah. These people do, my opinion, is number one, and I've talked about this a million times. First thing they do is they establish that the most evil thing in existence is racism. Nothing comes even close. Whatever you can imagine, racism is the worst thing. Then, anything they don't like, they associate it with racism. So they can destroy anything from Kate Smith to peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, as long as they can somehow tie that to racism. And it works. For some reason, we're still falling for it. And I don't know how long we are.
Yeah. I know. I don't know. I think that if we're going to have a future, we're going to have to jettison the fear of that term. But, okay, let's go on to another topic. Columnist begs suburbanites to return to Baltimore.
This was kind of a very strange story because the person who wrote it, the columnist who wrote it, was obviously not very keen on white people, but her appeal seemed to be, and I assumed it was a woman, I couldn't place the name, whether it was a male or female or ethnicity, but I think it was a woman. But her logic was that you racist, and this is not a quote, this is my opinion, you racist white people ran out to the suburbs and now you need to come home because you left all this mess. This seemed to be the point. But the odd thing was, is she admitted that, yeah, there's a violence problem in the black areas. She didn't call them black areas, but in Baltimore, which everybody knows is black. But, you know, still, there's a lot of good stuff to do here. You come to the library, or you can come to the, I don't know, art museum, or whatever they have in Baltimore. But just a very strange argument, but what she was doing, probably not intentionally, but inadvertently, is she was admitting, number one, that in the 21st century, well into the 21st century, racial segregation is a reality. And number two, which is the norm. I mean, it's just human nature. And number two, she was admitting that the reason we're segregated is because of violence in the black neighborhoods. Now, none of that did she say overtly. None of that did she say explicitly. It was all very implicit, but it was there. For example, let me see what she said here. What's more, evil can rear its ugly head anywhere, whether in places of worship like Christchurch, or Charleston, or a newsroom in Annapolis. So she's saying, see, you white people, you do bad things too. So it's kind of obvious she's drawing the divide between white and black.
Right, but I recently saw some sort of excerpt from some sort of dialogue on Twitter between two black people, and they're saying, you know, I hate this neighborhood, it's becoming gentrified, and all of these people are coming, all these white people are coming in, and they're just, and it's just, I have a rage, you see white people. And the response from another black man says, yeah, I mean, it used to be, seriously, you couldn't go out at night anymore. You couldn't go out at night, and now you can go out at night, and it's safe. It's just not the same as it used to be. And so someone says, yeah, curse those safe white communities, you know, because they hated the fact that white people were there. They acknowledged that they could go out at night now, it would be safe, and they hated that. They didn't like that. So it's everything that the white man does is wrong. And another one that someone posted on there, unrelated to this exchange, but it was also between two black people, and it said that, you know, dogs are racist. Because what happens is when they come into a community, these white boys will come out there with their dogs and they'll go walking looking for other white people to connect with. So their excuse, they have their dogs as an excuse to walk around and create a white community. So that those dogs are racist. And the other person says, yeah, that's right. So everything a white person does in the mind of these people is bad, whether it's making a community safe again, or whether it's walking your dog.
We tend to find what we're looking for. And if what we're looking for is white racism, we'll find it everywhere. Two people walking their dogs, what are they doing? They're out trying to connect with other white people, which I'm sure they're not. But this is natural, to connect with people who look like you do. So they interpret that as racism. But the point that I like to make every time I talk about this topic is that these neighborhoods, and I cannot think of a single exception, maybe you can, but every neighborhood in America that I can think of was built by white people. I can't think of one neighborhood anywhere where black people were the originators, that it was similarly a black neighborhood, and then white people moved in, or white people didn't move in. But every single black neighborhood was built by white people. White people used to live in those houses. Those houses were brand new. They were nice. They were just wonderful places to live. As were the storefronts at one time. So why did white people move out? Kind of an obvious question, but what do you think?
Well, they moved out because they instinctively wanted to live around their own people. And
because
these
they're
lesser...
racist, right?
What?
Because they're racist. That's what the left would say.
Well, I think that played a factor. You have an inclination to live around your own people. You feel more comfortable in your community that way. So I think that was a factor. But one scary thing is that you're talking about Baltimore as a black town. You know, Houston is a non-white town. Los Angeles, Denver, Dallas. Every single city is becoming predominantly non-white. We are seeing before our eyes the literal displacement, dispossession, and destruction of our people. So when is the reverse going to happen? When are we going to say, okay, I want Harlem back? Harlem was a Dutch name, H-A-A-R-L-E-M, just like it is in Holland. We want Harlem back for the Dutch. Roxbury, Massachusetts, where my ancestors came in the 1630s, which is a part of Boston. They came in, in 1636, just after the Mayflower, the Johnson line, anyway, the pace came before that. But in any event, when I was at Harvard Law School, I wanted to go see where my ancestors were buried. I wanted to go into Roxbury Cemetery. And I'd never been to Roxbury, but I'd never heard it before except in my genealogical books. So I rolled up my sleeves and I got in there and I got a taxi and it says, okay, I want you to take me to the Roxbury Cemetery. And the taxi driver, who was not white, he might have even been black, he says, sorry, sir, I'm not going there. And I said, well, why not? Because it's not safe. I'm not going to go into Roxbury. It's too dangerous. So I want Roxbury back. And so we need to start taking back all of these cities. And I told you, I want Haiti back. I want Haiti for white people. I want to start taking our cities back. And, maybe this is just a pipe dream, because we only talk about dispossession, and all the people coming in from all these other countries are just taking us over. At some point in time, I want to go the other direction, and I want to do that while I'm still alive.
Well, you'll remember a couple of years ago, I can't remember this guy's name, but he effectively bought several houses in a small town, got them for almost nothing, and he was going to set up a white community. His mistake was he told everybody what he was doing. So when I think about that, and I wonder, do you remember that guy's name?
Cobb. His name was Cobb. Yeah.
But I can't help but to wonder how many Cobbs there are out there who are starting white towns, but they're not telling anybody. They're doing it the smart way.
There is a lot of movement in that direction. And people are, I just read a comment now recently says, let's all get married, have 3, 4, 5 kids, and move into a small town and rehabilitate it. And so, if that picks up, there might be a semblance of a future for us. But I don't see it yet. Right now, there is too much entrenched opposition by white people against white people. And we live in a society where white people hate white people who like white people. And until we can overcome that hurdle, that barrier, that burden on our shoulders, we cannot achieve change. And it's coming. I think a lot of people on the right, a lot of Republicans are down on Donald Trump. They're saying, well, he's not achieving things. Ann Coulter has come out and said, well, I'm going to vote for Elizabeth Warren. Where's she for? I don't like Trump. He's not doing what he needs to do. But the point is that he is the start. He's beginning to open the door for us to stick our foot in. And what do the Muslims say? We got to use a Muslim example because they're taking over the country. He's allowing the nose of the camel to get under that tent. And once that camel's nose gets under the tent, he's going to be inside that tent before long. So Donald Trump is creating the crack for the nose of the camel to stick through.
It's okay to be white, but it's okay to say it's okay to be white. Have you noticed this? A little bit off topic, but Donald Trump seems to have almost a cult following. However, Barack Obama also had something of a cult following, still does. But I can't remember any president ever in history, at least not in my lifetime, that had the loyalty of a fan base like Donald Trump and Barack Obama. Totally off topic, but I thought...
No, that's exactly right. Those are two people with cult followings. And why do they have a cult following? Are they such extraordinary people? No. Barack Obama was as bland as you can. He had handlers that presented him in an acceptable manner. And you have Donald Trump that is a loose cannon. Neither of them are the type of people that you would think would attract a cult following. They are not as dynamic or as attractive as, say, a Ken Gibbidin, but they are have a huge following. Why? It is because they are the embodiment of a principle that their cult followers want to embrace. The embodiment that is Barack Obama is promoting the people of color, the black man, and have him be a leader. So all of these people were promoting not Barack Obama, but promoting the concept of a black man. And if you take, he's certainly a faulty figure for that concept, because I mean, he's of mixed race, and his father wasn't even an American. His father was from Africa. So you would think that they would take somebody who has deep roots in America on his black ancestry. They didn't. So it was because he was at the right place at the right time when massive numbers of people wanted to have a cult figure promoting blackism. And then Donald Trump is the exact opposite embodiment of that. You cannot find a more faulty figure than Donald Trump. But he is promoting whiteism, and so he has a following. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I disagree with you. I think Donald Trump intentionally portrays that image of a loose cannon, but I think it's more like controlled chaos. I have observed his MO, his mode of operation over the years, his business, the way he does business. And he intentionally, it seems, unless I'm misreading him, but he seems to intentionally create chaos. And then he steps in and he can control it. It's like he makes a big mess and then he says, hey, here I am to clean it up. But I've seen that when he wants to put up a tower or a golf course or whatever, he causes all kinds of trouble. I mean, he maligns the neighbors who are opposed to what he's doing. He just gets everybody on edge. And then he solves the problem. Now, I don't know if that's by design or just a personality trait.
But okay.
I think it's controlled chaos. I think he does that by design. And this Mueller thing. I can't help but to wonder if Donald Trump didn't know the outcome, but he just let the leftists hang themselves.
Okay. What I'm about to say is going to kill any chances of my being in the Trump administration, as if there was any possibility of that, is I think all of the bad things that the left says about Trump, his personality, is true. I think he truly is a crazy dude, but he's my crazy dude, and so I support him, you know, and I support him because he's leading the way to something bigger and better for us. But when they say that he has a vocabulary of a 10th grader, I think that's kind of true. In fact, one of his comments that they quote a lot, they say that words, I have the best words. My words are the best. Something like that. And so I just think his whole approach to life is just one big pinball in a pinball machine where he's bouncing from one issue to another, but he's moving forward in the same direction I want him to go. So I support him wholeheartedly. But, you know, that's my take.
What is the name of the black guy, I forget, who is the head of the Department of Housing and Urban Development?
Is that Kane?
Come on. What can I think of that?
Was that the what is it called, the medical doctor, the brain surgeon?
Yeah, he's a 7th day Adventist.
Yeah.
My mind is blank.
I know you're talking about you just call him the doctor.
Okay, the doctor.
Yeah.
When he got to know Donald Trump, he said something notoriously. He said, the real Donald Trump that I met is nothing like the guy you see on TV. And Trump jumped all over that. He said, no, I'm the same guy. But I think he was saying that whole TV persona. And by the way, Donald Trump is the only president that I can remember in my lifetime, probably ever. But he uses profanity when he makes public speeches. I mean, he goes to one of these campaign rallies and he just cusses up a storm. He uses words that I almost never use. Yeah, but
I know, and I believe, see, that shows your lack of mental fortitude. You just say, it just comes naturally. He uses swear words all the time because he can't use the mental gymnastics to say something, to take a more artful term. But anyway, don't get me wrong. I am Trump's biggest fan, but I kind of see his warts.
Ben Carson, thank you, Mark Hansen in the chat.
Okay, Ben Carson. Okay.
What is it about our brains just goes blank when we're trying to think of something like that?
Well, it's because you're 66 and I'm 64. That's what it is.
I've been 66 for a very long time. It's my mind.
Yeah. All right. Well, we kind of got off topic. What we were talking about? Were we talking about? Oh, return to Baltimore.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's just finish up with this on this theory. Is that really? I made this comment before. Is that I see gentrification taking place in a lot of communities in Los Angeles. Just two of them that come to mind, and there are great challenges to gentrification because, one, when we start to move into an area, the prices skyrocket and it keeps other white people from moving in. And what happens is the people that are already there, they won't want to move out because their home values have gone up and the schools have gotten better and their community is nicer, it's safer, and so they won't want to sell and they want to live around us. And then those that can move in start to move in, and particularly the ones that are race mixers. They want to live around whites, but they want to be race mixers. The black man who likes the white woman, or the white man who likes the oriental wife, they want to move into those areas too. So there's just all sorts of challenges within gentrification because it will not stay white. As soon as whites start coming in together, everybody else starts to glom on there, and that's partially human nature, it's partially capitalism. So it is a difficult barrier to achieve. And so if people start doing what like this Cobb did, and they want to go to little communities and create little white communities, they say, oh, let's all get married, have four or five kids, and move into a white community, people of color and mixed race couples, they're all going to want to move in there. They're going to want to be amongst us. And that prohibits us from having our own communities. And the laws are such as that if we try to have some sort of restrictive covenants that we used to have in the 20s and the 30s, the laws will take everything we have against us and give away. The lawsuits will just devastate those who try to maintain the integrity. So we have to have a separate ethnostate with a separate law that we just live among ourselves, and then we can rebuild.
Well, it would be fun to try Morania in America. Have you ever noticed that if you refuse to give black people a mortgage, the leftists will call it redlining, but if you do give them a mortgage, they call it predatory lending. You can't win. Did you want to take a minute to talk about this multi-python? We're down to like 2 minutes.
I don't know what that is. We can if you want. Which one is it?
There's a guy by the name of Terry Gilliam. He was a member of Monty Python, which is a British comedy troupe. And he told an interviewer that he's being tired of blamed for everything because he's a white male. And what prompted this was a year ago. Whoever was in charge of comedy at BBC. They had somebody in charge of comedy. But he said something to the effect that never again would there be an all-white male or an all-white comedy troupe on BBC. That was a thing of the past. And so just this, week ago, Terry Gilliam was quoted as saying, you know, stop blaming us for everything.
One of the Monty Python people, and it might have been the same one, says, you know, I walk down London streets and I don't recognize it. It's not my country anymore. So, you know, those Monty Python people were promoting the destruction of our society back before it was destroyed. You know, they promoted the anti-Christian lampooning, you know, the Life of Brian, or they were doing all these sketches that lampooned the people who wanted to preserve, lampooning you and me. And now the chickens have come home to roost. They've realized that what they were doing is destructive. So what do? They will make some sort of limp wrist statement saying, oh, stop blaming white people. but nothing more. I mean, it's our generation, the baby boom generation, have destroyed Western civilization. So it's up to the younger generation to take it.
That guy, by the way, was John Cleese. Well, I know we're out of time, but an interesting...
Also, there's two different ones, yeah. So, you know, but whatever.
An interesting story about John Cleese, just real quick, because I knew that. But he's the only guy named Cleese in Britain. Because his dad made up the name. That's it. It's just kind of an interesting tidbit of trivia.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. And he probably doesn't have any kids, so there's going to be no future Cleeses, you know?
I don't know about that. He may have some.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Ken, it's been a good discussion. We'll hopefully next week it'll be a little bit wider here.
Okay. Have a good evening. Take care.
All right. Thanks a lot.